Good morning. It's 10:15. Well, 10:16. I'm calling this meeting of the Committee on Taxes to order for Tuesday, April 7th, 2026. The first item on our agenda is approval of the minutes from March 26th, 2026. Representative Johnson. Oh, no, you're busy. Representative Roach, will you move the minutes from March 26th, please?
I have not looked at them. But
okay, I can have somebody else do it if you don't want to. Representative Witte? Representative Davis, will you move the minutes, please? Somebody help me out here.
Chair, I have not read the minutes. I'm sure they're right, and I move them.
All right, an orderly beginning to Tax Committee. Chair Davis has moved approval of the minutes for March 26, 2026. If there are any problems with it, we're blaming him only. All those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries. The minutes for March 26, 2026 are adopted. All right, so we have, I think, four bills today. First up on the agenda is House File 4621. Representative Ream, welcome back to the committee. I'm going to move that House File 4621 be laid over for possible inclusion in the 2026 tax bill. Representative Ream, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Gomez, and thank you, members of the committee. I'm happy to introduce House File 4621. It's a bill to expand the per-child amount for the Minnesota Child Credit. House File 4621 increases the per-child amount of the Minnesota Child Credit from $1,800 to $2,000, and the bill is effective for tax year 2026. So just a little background on the bill. The Minnesota Child Tax Credit is a refundable income tax credit based on the number of taxpayers qualifying children ages 17 and younger. The credit is $1,800 per child in tax year 2026. The child credit is administered jointly with the state's working family credit, which is a credit based on the taxpayer's earned income. The working family credit equals 4% of the first $9,690 of the taxpayer's earned income for a maximum credit of $388. Taxpayers are also allowed a separate credit for qualifying older children, which is defined as an 18-year-old dependent child or a 19 to 24-year-old dependent who is a student or has a disability. So the combined amount of a taxpayer's child credit and working family credit is phased out beginning at $38,770 of adjusted gross income for married joint filers and $32,680 for other filers. For a taxpayer with two children, the credit is fully phased out at $72,000 for married joint taxpayers and $65,910 for unmarried taxpayers. And with that, I do have a couple of people here to testify. And would appreciate any conversation on the bill.
Thank you very much, Representative Ream. There are a couple of testifiers who've signed up. First up is Nan Madden, and on deck, Alexandra Fitzsimmons. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself as you get started.
Thank you, Chair Gomez and Chair Davids. My name is Nan Madden. I'm director of the Minnesota Budget Project. And thank you so much for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 4621 to increase the child tax credit. And I thank Representative Ream for bringing this bill forward. In the 2023 legislative session, Minnesota passed a nation-leading child tax credit after a robust debate in which policymakers from both sides of the aisle introduced bills on the subject. Minnesota's child tax credit built on learning about what had been successful at the federal level and what fell short, and combined that with improvements to include a broad range of Minnesota kids and families. In doing so, Minnesota policymakers took bold action to enact a high-impact policy that moves our state forward moves our state forward towards becoming a place where every child can thrive and participate in this state's opportunities. Today, 17 states and the District of Columbia have child tax credits. These credits provide qualifying families with more resources to pay for the basic expenses that come with raising children, whether that's diapers, rent, groceries, or expenses for school. It respects parents as decision makers about where those additional dollars are best spent to meet the particular needs and priorities of their family. Overall, the child tax credit seeks to reduce economic hardship for kids and families, to narrow disparities in economic well-being, especially for children living in rural areas and children of color, and improve the lifetime prospects of Minnesota children. Minnesota has also been very successful through education and outreach efforts in reaching families eligible for the child tax credit and has achieved a high participation rate. At a time that so many Minnesotans are struggling to afford the basics, I thank the committee for considering what role Minnesota's child tax credit can play in strengthening family economic security in every corner of the state. Given the state's tight fiscal position in the next biennium and the federal funding cuts and threats to affordable health care, food support, and other public services, we encourage you to move this proposal forward as part of an omnibus tax bill that also raises revenues overall to fund and protect the services that Minnesotans count on. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Madden. Up next, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself as you get started.
Thank you, Chair Gomez and Chair Davids. My name is Alexandra Fitzsimmons, and I'm the Senior Policy Director with Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. And I'm here to testify in strong support of House File 4621, which increases Minnesota's child tax credit by $200 per child, because this two-generational policy proposal is fundamentally about child well-being. These cute little shoes are baby tennis shoes. Families use the child tax credit for basics like this pair of shoes because children are always growing and changing. Making sure those tiny feet start off in the right direction begins early and continues throughout childhood. Research consistently shows that family income is one of the strongest predictors of child outcomes. Economist Greg Duncan's research finds that increased income in early childhood leads to higher achievement, more years of formal education, and higher earnings in adulthood. And research also shows that stability throughout childhood and adolescence matters too. Support during the school years is linked to better academic performance, and in adolescence to higher graduation rates, improved mental health, and stronger transitions into young adulthood. Together, this tells us that while early childhood is especially important, children benefit from economic stability as they grow, not just at one point in time. Today, many families are facing increasing financial pressure. Changes at the federal level, along with rising costs for everyday essentials, mean that many families need to do more with less. In Minnesota, about one in four children live in low-income families. Half of Black and American Indian children and 4 in 10 Latino children are growing up in low-income households compared to 1 in 5 white children. These gaps begin early and they shape opportunities over time. Strengthening the child tax credit helps families afford the basics children need and provides greater stability along the way. Minnesota has already taken an important step by creating a strong refundable child tax credit, and this bill builds on that success. An additional $200 per child will help families meet basic needs and provide greater stability, particularly for children and families with lower incomes where the impact is greatest. This is not just tax policy. It is an evidence-based investment in children's health, education, and long-term success. And families use this credit for the basics children need for things like shoes, other baby necessities, food, and school supplies, costs that come again and again as children grow. Strengthening this credit helps ensure that as children grow, learn, explore, and dream, families can keep up and those tiny feet can stay on the right path. Thank you for thoughtfully considering Children's Defense Fund Minnesota's support of House File 4621 and placing the well-being of children and families at the center of your decision-making. Thank you for your time and your service.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else present who wishes to testify on House File 4621? Not seeing any, we'll move to member discussion. All right, that's easy enough. Representative Ream, any final comments about your bill?
Thank you, members, for hearing this bill. So we passed the historic child tax credit in 2023 with bipartisan support. I look forward to building on that success, and I just want to highlight something that Minnesota Legal Aid put out in a letter in your packet. It says, today, even in an alleged strong Minnesota economy and labor market, the rising costs of food, diapers, and fuel are hurting the families we represent at a level unseen in recent memory. Food shelves are collapsing under the demand. Deep federal cuts to SNAP are now beginning to hit thousands of Minnesota households with children. Parents are watching the cost of some basic household and hygiene items double, and working parents do not always have the luxury of shopping around for a better deal. We continue to ask our families to do more with less, and that structure is unsustainable. So in closing, I'd just like to say thank you for considering this bill. I'd love to see some bipartisan support for this. I think our children deserve no less. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Ream. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 4621 be laid over for possible inclusion in the 2026 tax bill, and it is laid over. All right, up next on the agenda, I'm going to hand the gavel over to Vice Chair Norris. We're going to do this a little bit differently than we normally do. So we have two bills, Representative Agbaje's 4123 and my 4616. And a number of people wanted to testify on both bills. So what we're going to do is Representative Agbaje is going to go up and present her bill. Then I'm going to go up and present my bill. Then we're going to hear from the public, and we're going to have public testimony. And after that, we will move to member discussion, first on Rep. Agbaje's bill and then on my bill. So hopefully that works for everybody. Representative Agbaje would like to move that House. No. Oh, we're not moving the bills till after. Okay. I'm going to hand this over to Representative Norris. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Agbaje. Please proceed with the introduction of your bill, which is House File 4123.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair and members, I'm here to present House File 4123. This bill expands upon a bill that we had passed a couple of years ago and on the net income investment tax. And so this bill is intended to expand the definition of what is considered net investment income, and thus expanding the base of who would be subject to this tax. Under this bill, the income subject to this tax would now include income from a trade or a business that is not subject to the federal Medicare or Social Security taxes on self-employment income. The expansion will primarily affect people who make income from an S corporation or an LLC structured business. The tax rate remains the same as it is in current law and only applies to income over $1 million that would qualify, similar to current law. The revenue anticipated from this tax is supposed to be about $88.7 million in the next tax year. And so the purpose of this is really to continue to find ways to expand the revenue coming into the state of Minnesota to meet the needs of the state. And so that's the quick summary, and then we'll wait for testifiers and member discussion.
Great. Thank you, Representative Agbaje. Next, we've got Chair Gomez to describe House File 4616. Chair Gomez, please proceed with your presentation when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So House File 4616 imposes a 1% tax annually on fortunes above $10 million. And so this is a different kind of tax base than we have in Minnesota, and I believe a different tax base than anyone in the country, any state revenue kind of code in the country touches. And, you know, this really comes from, for me, I've heard my entire life these statistics about the top 1% and how much wealth they own and how much income they get. And, you know, I'm in my mid-40s. It's just gotten worse and worse and worse. That's my perception, is every time I hear somebody cite that statistic, it's like it's more shocking and it's worse. As of this year, the top 1% own more than 30% of the wealth in this country. It's $55 trillion. And that's as much wealth as is held by the bottom 90% by the rest of us. So people have talked about, I mean, I think this is a little bit remote from our experience. But I think, but I want us to think about this for a second. What has happened in our country is that increasingly working class people, middle class people, have a harder and harder time making ends meet. We all live in the world. The cost of housing continues to go up. The cost of healthcare just goes up and up and up. The cost of food and utilities, these are issues that we all hear about from our communities. And so at the same time that regular working people are increasingly burdened by the costs of the basics, we also have a class of people in our country who are just getting richer and richer as the rest of us struggle to get by, as wages fail to keep up with inflation, let alone the increase in the cost of living. We heard a lot about the K-shaped recovery after COVID, that, you know, kind of like rich people really, they did okay. They pulled out of what happened during COVID and really made a lot of money. And that's why we had a giant surplus. Most of that came from capital gains and investment income, taxes on capital gains. And we can really think of our economy now as being K-shaped. I read this article recently. I live right near Lake and Nicollet in Minneapolis, and a few blocks from my house in my neighborhood, there is a CSL plasma donation place, right? Place, and communities like mine have, for, you know, as long as selling plasma has been a thing, they have situated those businesses in communities like mine. But I read this really interesting article about how now, in the last 5 years, CSL Plasma and other businesses like that are increasingly building their facilities in middle-class neighborhoods. And I read stories about, you know, people who work full-time, some of them work two jobs, and it's like they're just not able to make ends meet. And so selling plasma has become this side gig, increasingly for middle-class people. So that's the world that we're living in. That's the country that we're living in. The richest country that's ever existed on the face of the earth, with the wealthiest people that have ever existed, the most profitable companies that have ever existed. We have people living on our streets. We have kids who don't have a place to lay their head at night. We have people who are employed full-time, who are selling their blood to make their mortgage, to buy their food. People talk about this as a new Gilded Age. The Gilded Age was a time, I think it was like Mark Twain wrote about it. He talked about a shimmering surface that obscured deep inequality and conflict underneath. And as we look at this issue of wealth and income inequality, and we look at our political system, our democratic institutions, which are increasingly influenced by the money of the incredibly uber wealthy, we see that there was instability inherent in that Gilded Age. And the times that have been where wealth has been as stratified as it is now in the history of our country have precipitated things like the Great Depression. Because a society where children can't eat, but we're on the verge of having our first trillionaire, it's unjust, and we all know it. Everybody knows it as we look around. Everybody feels it. Everybody feels like that it's wrong, that most of us are struggling to pay our bills. And then there's like a few people who are just making out like bandits. The robber barons of the 19th century controlled railroads, they controlled industry, they controlled kind of manufacturing. And those are things that we have a way of taxing. They made income, and we have a way of taxing that. What we have now in our current Gilded Age is an economy that's based a lot on tech and on financialization of everything. So that means like people aren't making money from making widgets or making things or moving goods around the country. They're making money, these literal trillion-dollar fortunes are being made by big tech, right? Selling our data, exploiting our kids. We don't have a good way of taxing that. And financialization, trading on everything. Like, housing isn't housing. It's like a way to make money. It's a way to extract money. And so what we have is a tax system that is outdated when you look at its ability to actually raise revenue from the way that the economy is developing. And so this is an attempt to right-size that. And it might not be like the exact right approach. It might not be the right numbers. But I'm really, it's very important that we have this conversation. We're having a conversation in the sales tax space about the fact that our sales tax is outdated when compared to the way that the economy has developed with respect to goods and services. Representative Lee talked to us about that last week. And we have a similar situation in the income tax. I know that we're going to hear about unrealized gains from Representative Smith, and so I don't want to steal his fire, but we have to understand the kind of approach of buy, borrow, die, that when you have wealth being held in assets that you can borrow against, right? Smart rich people don't take an income. They don't realize a gain. I told you guys about this last year. I have a rich friend, and he was buying a second home, like a, you know, a cabin for his family, and I was like, oh, well, did you just bought it with cash? And he laughed at me, and he was like, of course I didn't buy it with cash. If I were to buy my $250,000 second home for my family with cash, I would have had to sell some assets, which means that I would have had capital gain, which means that I would have had to pay taxes on that. If I just keep my assets, if I just keep my, you know, my money in the stock market, I can borrow against it. That doesn't count as a gain. It actually, I could take a mortgage interest deduction on the other side if I do that. And so you buy assets, you borrow against them to live off of, and then when you pass it on to your heirs, even if your fortune has gone from $1 million to $10 million over your lifetime, that $9 million increase, nobody ever pays any taxes on it. It gets passed on with a stepped-up basis to your heirs. And we already do tax wealth in this country and in this state and in every one of our communities. We do. You may say, what wealth tax? We don't do that. We do. We tax the wealth of middle-class and working-class people every single year. Because most of us, the one thing that we own, the one asset that we own is a home. Okay? So that's the asset that I own. Every year, they assess the value of my asset. They apply a classification rate. We have a levy that is imposed, and I pay taxes, wealth tax, on my one asset every single year, as does every other middle-class person. And so all we're saying is that the wealth of the wealth of the rich should be taxed just the same as the wealth of middle class and working class people. So as I said, I mean, you know, there are questions about this bill. I'm sure we're going to hear from some folks about them. You know, how does the state assess the value of, you know, somebody's wealth? It would be a new thing. We're going to have to work that out. Is $10 million the right level? Is 1% the right rate? I'm not sure. But all of those questions can be worked out. I really truly believe that this is an effort to modernize our tax code so that it actually aligns with the way that the world is. And potentially, you know, through investments like we just heard about Representative Ream's increase in the child tax bill, paid family medical leave, things that relieve the pressures on middle class and working class people's pocketbooks. Like when you have a baby, maybe you shouldn't have to choose between bonding with them and, you know, going to work. And those are the kind of basic supports that we as a society, right, we can come together and say it's not right for people to be in that situation, regardless of their income. You know, I have to say that we think about taxes as divorced from what they buy. But taxes pay for things. Taxes provide for the public good. If you like there being somebody on the other end when you call 911, if your house is on fire or if your, you know, kid breaks their leg and you can't get them to the hospital, thank taxes. If you like that, no matter where you live in this state, I live in a very dense community. Some of you represent very sparsely populated communities, but guess what? You can still get a letter delivered to your house. Why do you think that is? It's not magic, it's taxes, right? And so when we allow these runaway fortunes with no contribution to the public coffers, we are disinvesting in our communities. And so I look forward to the conversation about this, and I thank you for the time, Mr. Chair, and committee members.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. As Chair Gomez explained, we're going to move on now to testimony from the public on both House File 4123 and House File 4616. And the first person up is Nan Madden. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nan Madden. I'm director of the Minnesota Budget Project, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to some of the important context for this tax debate that is happening here in Minnesota and in states across the country. As you've heard, it's a time of increasing concentration of wealth and wide income inequality. And while we don't have a position on the specific details of these bills, we thank the committee for considering what role Minnesota tax policy can play in pushing back against income inequality, wealth inequality, and addressing disparities in tax policy. For example, Minnesota's net investment income tax and the concept of a wealth tax really shines a spotlight on the types of income that are largely concentrated among higher income households and that benefit from preferential tax treatment at the federal level. Minnesota's net investment income tax, as it currently stands, assesses an additional tax on the proceeds generated by owning wealth. It builds on a federal net investment income tax, which was created in 2013, in part in response to ways that the federal tax system preferences income from wealth over income from work. You've heard how the wealthiest 1% of American households own nearly 32% of all U.S. wealth, and we think this massive concentration of wealth violates our nation's value of being a place with opportunity for all. Another key part of the context for this debate is the significant federal tax cuts that high-income households received in the federal budget reconciliation bill called H.R. 1. Analysis by the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy finds that in 2026, the richest 1% of Minnesota households will get average federal tax cuts of more than $52,000. At the same time, H.R. 1 makes drastic funding and program cuts to Medicaid and SNAP and permanently shifts more responsibility to fund and deliver those services to our state and counties. More revenues are needed to address these challenges, and it makes sense to look to those with the greatest resources to contribute more to support public services that benefit us all. We appreciate this committee exploring a number of ways to do so. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up is Brian Cook, and on deck is Erica Mum. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Great. Thanks, Vice Chair Norris. Members of the House Taxes Committee, my name is Brian Cook. I'm the Director of Tax, Fiscal Policy, and Elections for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Chamber represents more than 6,300 businesses of all sizes in all corners of the state with more than 500,000 employees. I want to note 75% of our members are small or medium-sized businesses with fewer than 100 employees. Appreciate the opportunity to share our concerns with Representative Agbaje's House File 4123, which would expand the state's net investment income tax, or NIIT, to business income, and Chair Gomez's House File 4616, which would create an annual wealth tax in the state of Minnesota. So starting with House File 4123, in 2024, Minnesota started applying the NIIT tax of 1% on individual income taxpayers with over $1 million of certain types of income, including capital gains, interest, dividends, largely mirroring the federal NIIT. This bill would expand the NIIT in Minnesota to include business income that is paid through the individual income tax system, in essence creating a new fifth-tier income tax for many small and medium-sized businesses. Minnesota already has the sixth highest personal income tax in the nation. Businesses paying this proposed higher NIIT would be paying 10.85% on this income, the fourth highest in the nation, moving past Oregon and New Jersey and only being behind New York, Hawaii, and California. Regionally, comparable businesses would pay 3.2% more in Minnesota than in Wisconsin, 7.05% more than in Iowa, 8.35% more than in North Dakota, and of course, South Dakota does not impose a personal income tax. Many of the businesses who would be impacted by this expansion of the NIIT are also impacted by the expiration of the state's pass-through entity tax and will be paying higher federal tax bills a week from tomorrow, absent quick action from this committee. Instituting new business income taxes primarily on small and medium-sized Minnesota-based businesses will do nothing to encourage more economic growth in our state. It will only discourage more businesses from starting and growing here. As for House File 4616, no other state has a wealth tax designed like this. The other state that is most strongly considering one is California via a ballot initiative. That wealth tax would be a one-time tax on wealth over $1 billion at 5% compared to this proposal with a much lower threshold at $10 million and which would be levied annually. Wealth taxes can present a lot of issues and questions in their application and introduces risk for businesses, their owners, and investors. For example, should a taxpayer pay a wealth tax on their business's assets in a year where they operate at a loss and there's no cash available to pay? Or what if their business income is primarily tied up in non-liquid assets? Should these taxpayers be faced to liquidate them, pay a capital gains tax in order to pay their new annual Minnesota wealth tax? Forcing businesses to confront these questions, which would be unique in our state and in no others, would supercharge an already difficult tax climate. As shown in the Minnesota Chamber Foundation's 2026 Business Benchmark Report, our state is already lagging the rest of the country in GDP growth per capita, labor force growth rate, and net domestic migration. Every single day, our state is in a competition for investment, jobs, and people. Rather than helping address these negative trends for our state's growth and economic success, House Files 4123 and 4616 would likely exacerbate them. A final point that I think is important to note is that while these bills may not become law this year, the introduction of bills like these, and more notably holding hearings on them, sends a loud and clear message to employers and investors inside and outside of Minnesota. Close attention is paid to tax debates at the Capitol, and the potential costs of proposals like these are taken at face value. Companies and investors run the numbers and conduct scenario planning for consequential tax proposals which could impact their operations, expansion plans, investment strategies, or consideration of alternative locations. While some in the room may view that as a feature and not a bug, it does have a very real and very negative impact on how Minnesota is perceived as a place to do business, invest, or live in. Policymakers should focus on growing the economic pie through opportunities such as federal tax conformity, lower rates, and a stable and reliable tax structure. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is Erica Mum, followed by Lauren Richards. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Co-Chairs Gomez, Norris, Davids, and members of the committee. My name is Erica Mum. I am an epidemiologist for the Minnesota Department of Health, but today I'm testifying in my capacity as a member of the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees, my labor union, which represents over 18,000 workers from all state agencies, boards, and commissions. Thank you for allowing me to voice my support for House File 4123 and 4616. House File 4123 and 4616 are a step forward in generating meaningful revenue needed to support state agencies and programs that Minnesotans depend on. Expanding the net investment income tax to include business income and instating a 1% tax on property in the state above $10 million is a logical approach to ensuring that we continue to take care of our neighbors by focusing new revenue on those with the highest levels of wealth to support essential services and long-term stability. Over the past year, we have had unprecedented uncertainty in funding our state's public health infrastructure. The federal government has prematurely ended funding from multiple grants that have resulted in layoffs and the termination of many contract employees. Although our agency has worked hard to tighten its budget and not backfill many positions, this has undeniably caused strains on our normal workload and job uncertainty for our current workforce. Our infectious disease division is currently 90% federally funded. We investigate foodborne and sexually transmitted disease outbreaks assess animal bites for rabies risk, coordinate vaccine distribution, and support healthcare workers in preventing the transmission of healthcare-associated infections. These roles are critical to the health of Minnesotans, and we are at risk of losing them because we do not control the funding source. I work as a respiratory disease epidemiologist conducting surveillance for hospitalized cases of RSV. This data is so important to protect vulnerable populations that are most at risk for severe disease, such as infants and the elderly. This year, we were able to identify that RSV is continuing to circulate in Minnesota and recommend the extension of the use of seasonal immunizations to eligible infants and young children past the typical end date. When public health works, you rarely hear about it in your day-to-day life because our work is preventing health disasters. It is vital that we continue to adequately fund the quiet and powerful work of protecting the health of Minnesotans. We ask that you not only pass these bills, but that you strongly consider identifying additional sources of revenue to begin backfilling the current and anticipated cuts to our public health and safety net programs, as this is likely only the beginning. Again, thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. Next is Lauren Richards, followed by Dalton Danielson. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair and members, my name is Lauren Richards, and I'm one of the owners of Tropes and Trifles, an independent bookstore in Minneapolis. I support HF 4616 and HF 4123 because I believe taxes provide the resources for us collectively to take care of each other. Wealthy individuals and corporations should pay their fair share of taxes just like small businesses do. In fact, adopting wealth taxes is pro-small business. I filed my taxes yesterday. My business is an S-Corp, so we file as individuals, and my household paid 20% in federal and state income taxes last year. Amazon, in contrast, paid a 1.4% effective tax rate, hardly its fair share. Amazon sells the same books I carry in my store at a loss because they want to put me out of business, and yet I pay a greater percentage of my income to maintain the roads they use to deliver packages in my neighborhood. The low tax rate they pay is just one of the ways many government policies benefit large corporations over small businesses. As a small business owner, I invest in my community. That money comes back to us as a business, and I'm happy to contribute because I love living and working in Minnesota. I want my small business to stay small so I can keep doing my favorite part of my job, which is helping people find books that show them the possibility of a better world. Adopting these wealth taxes would help my small business by taking a step towards leveling the playing field, and the additional tax revenue could be used to create a better and more fair Minnesota for everyone. That is how to truly support small businesses. Thank you for your time. Please vote in favor of both these bills.
Thank you. Next, we have Dalton Danielson, followed by Kristen Sinicariello. Please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Vice Chair Norris. Members, my name is Dalton Danielson, Fiscal Policy Director with the Minnesota Business Partnership. We appreciate the committee's focus on long-term budget stability, but we must respectfully oppose House File 4616, which establishes a new Minnesota wealth tax. This bill would impose a new annual 1% tax on assets above $10 million, applied not only to liquid wealth, but also to business interests, intangible property, and pass-through entities, including interests held by non-residents with Minnesota connections. While often framed as affecting only a narrow population, the structure of this tax would directly and indirectly impact operating businesses, entrepreneurs, and job creators across the state. This policy sends a negative signal to investors and employers deciding where to locate their capital. Minnesota already competes with other states for headquarters, talent, and investment. An annual wealth tax on top of existing income, corporate, estate, and property taxes makes Minnesota a clear outlier and increases the risk of capital flight and foregone investment. Members, this is not just about a wealth tax. It is about the cumulative impact on Minnesota's economy. From our headquarters economy to Main Street suppliers, Policies that discourage long-term investment ultimately affect workers, communities, and the state's tax base. Ultimately, we believe Minnesota would be better served by policies that attract and retain the individuals and entrepreneurs who invest, start companies, and employ Minnesotans, a growing base of residents across Minnesota who choose to live, work, and invest here generates ongoing income, sales, property, and business tax revenue. That approach is more sustainable than an annual wealth tax that risks driving investment and the economic activity tied to it out of state. For these reasons, the Minnesota Business Partnership respectfully urges the committee to oppose House File 4616 and instead focus on tax policies that strengthen Minnesota's competitiveness, grow the economy, and support sustainable revenue growth. Thank you.
Thank you. Next we have Kristen Sinicariello, and following is John Besci. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kristen Sinicariello, and I'm a world history teacher at Columbia Heights High School and a member of the Columbia Heights Federation of Teachers, Local 710. As educators, we depend on tax revenues to fund our needs in the classroom, but we also create the foundation for our modern economy. Without teachers and schools, there would be no lawyers, no doctors, and no state representatives. My students have gone on to careers in the trades, in cybersecurity, in biomedical research, joined the military, etc. I love our school and the community we serve in Columbia Heights. However, it is impossible to avoid the inequalities we face in districts like Heights. For this reason, we enthusiastically support bills like House File 4123 and 4616, which raise taxes on those who have profited the most from our productive economy, so we can use the money to continually sustain the teachers and classrooms that enabled that wealth in the first place. Unfortunately, our schools today reflect the inequities of our modern economy. Low-income areas have fewer resources and higher needs, which contribute to uneven outcomes and structural inequality. As a soccer coach, I have witnessed these inequalities firsthand through the eyes of my players. During the fall season, as we travel to other schools around the metro, the players are always in awe of some of the facilities and resources that they see. I watch as our soccer players press their faces against the windows of the bus and say, "Wow, this is a rich school," or "Why don't we have these fancy locker rooms or turf fields?" I watch as they unload the bus using the same backpacks and warm-ups that were purchased 6 years ago, mismatched and now stained. Beyond the field, there are other inequalities that are less visible. For example, we don't have any academic counselors in Columbia Heights middle or high schools. Deans and behavior supports have been cut from the elementary schools. We no longer have media specialists in our school libraries. And as teaching positions are cut to save money, our class sizes soar. Teachers and support staff do our best to fill in the gaps, but there's a huge detriment to our students that exacerbate education inequalities in Minnesota. I am so proud of our students in Heights and how we build community and success despite the funding squeeze our district faces, but this is why state revenue is so important. Through state general ed funding and universal high-quality education, we equalize educational opportunities and grant students a chance to achieve their full potential. Bills like House File 4123 and 4616 will not only provide essential funding to improve educational outcomes and future prosperity, but they will also help to equalize our enormous wealth inequalities, which are destabilizing our social and political systems here in Minnesota. Billionaires are leveraging their wealth to capture our political system, attack public education, and erode trust in public institutions. As a state, we must remind ourselves of the collective efforts it takes to maintain the society, and we must commit to this maintenance.
If you
bills
could
like this
wrap
are a step
up,
in the
please.
Right direction. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is John Besci, followed by Carly Louise Statham Lang. Welcome to the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Gomez, Chair Davids, and members of the committee. My name is John Besci, and I am the State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business in Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to provide comment today. NFIB represents about 10,000 small and independently owned businesses across the state, and our members span every industry and serve local communities throughout Minnesota. NFIB opposes House File 4616, which would impose a new annual tax on wealth, which is broadly defined to include the value of all of the taxpayers' property, real or personal, tangible or intangible. In other words, this is a tax on total asset value, not income. Our members frequently cite tax burdens as one of the biggest problems that are facing their businesses, with top marginal individual income tax rate of 9.85%, growing property tax liabilities, and increased payroll taxes due to new mandates. Minnesota small businesses are already grappling with some of the highest tax burdens in the country. We are concerned about the impact that this new tax would have on small business owners, particularly those who structure their business as a pass-through entity. Main Street businesses across Minnesota hold a mix of property types that would be subject to this new tax, including land, buildings, machinery, tools, equipment, and more. Depending on how the business is structured, a small business owner could be subject to the increased tax liability based on their personal ownership of property used in the business or their individual ownership stake in the business. In other words, if the value of the business or business assets pushes them over the threshold, these folks would be subject to this new tax, even if the assets are tied up in the business and not liquid. We are also concerned with the broader economic impact that this new tax will have on Minnesota's competitiveness and entrepreneurial environment. According to the Tax Foundation's 2026 State Tax Competitiveness Index, Minnesota currently ranks only 44th in overall state tax competitiveness, which places us in the 10 lowest ranked states. A higher perceived tax risk in Minnesota affects business formation, expansion decisions, and whether owners reinvest profit or move operations. Instead of entertaining new ways to increase taxes on Minnesotans, we believe that the legislature should be exploring policies that improve our state's tax competitiveness and bolster economic growth. Finally, we are concerned with the precedent that this proposed tax would set. Once in place, the threshold of what constitutes wealth could be decreased over time, which would place an even more increased tax burden on additional business owners who are just trying to grow their business. I also want to note we have similar concerns with House File 4123, which would essentially tax active business income, like was previously mentioned, creating a fifth-tier income tax in essence. This is also another additional tax burden that small businesses do not need at this time. Thank you for the opportunity to provide comments. We respectfully ask the committee to oppose these bills. Thank you.
Thank you. Next we have Carly Louise Statham Liang, followed by Mark Haveman. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Norris, members of the committee. My name is Carly Statham Liang. My husband and I are both attorneys, and we live in Minneapolis with our three young boys. I'm here on behalf of We Make Minnesota and Southwest Alliance for Equity, a community group in Minneapolis. Thank you for the opportunity to share my support for these two bills that would raise needed state tax revenue from wealthy Minnesotans like myself. When I heard about these bills, I was eager to come share my support, even as someone whose family would likely pay more as a result of these bills. Families like mine are fortunate not to have to stress about how to afford housing, food, or childcare. But there are many things we cannot afford to buy on our own. Clean streets, good schools, and greater public safety are just a few examples of things that we can only secure collectively through public policy. I saw this firsthand during the ICE surge when my neighbors and I, in our well-resourced neighborhood in Minneapolis, raised as much money as we could to help pay rent for our immigrant neighbors. But despite our best efforts, we could not raise enough. This drove home to me that we can't rely on private individuals' generosity alone to pay for social goods like housing. We need the state government's help. I'm aware that critics warn that such policies will chase wealthy people away from our state. However, I am here to say that wealthy families like mine instead choose to move to states that invest in the well-being of all their residents. In fact, in early 2025, my husband and I chose to move to Minnesota, in part because Minnesota has invested in public goods in ways that our prior community hadn't. Minneapolis felt safer, and also we were so impressed by the amazing park system, especially Theodore Worth, and also the local parks with their wading pools and rec centers. These community investments have made Minnesota a great place for us to live, and we are so thankful for that. I urge you to pass these two bills so Minnesota can be a great place for all Minnesotans to live. Thank you.
Thank you. Next we have Mark Haveman, followed by Jada Scott. Welcome to the committee. Please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Vice Chair Norris, members. My name is Mark Haveman. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence. We are a research and education organization in support of sound tax policy, efficient, effective government, and fiscal responsibility. My comments today will focus exclusively on House File 4616, and I want to focus my comments today on a very practical question this committee should consider about a proposal like this. Is it even possible for a state to administer a tax like this? The bill requires the Department of Revenue to annually value every asset owned by affected taxpayers. Stocks are straightforward, and bonds and other sort of market-based assets are straightforward. But the wealthy hold a lot of alternative assets, including closely held businesses, private partnerships, real estate, intellectual property, tangible property of all types, art collections, private equity, minority interests, and complex entities, just to name a few. The bill ties valuation to the state to the federal estate tax standard under Internal Revenue Code Section 2031. That standard was designed for a one-time valuation at death and features professional appraisers, often leading to litigation and years to resolve disputes. This bill proposes that every single year for over 5,600 taxpayers on a filing deadline, the methodological challenges on making mark-to-market adjustments every year are fundamentally different from valuing one time at death. There doesn't appear to be a fiscal note accompanying this bill, but there would need to be one because it almost certainly require a massive staffing investment on behalf of the Department of Revenue to administer this. The governor's budget, for example, the governor's budget proposes a new 13 FTE audit unit just to handle pass-through entity tax return compliance. This legislation will require annual evaluation of every asset owned by thousands of taxpayers, requiring teams of specialized professionals and forensic accounting, appraisals, valuation specialists, and attorneys to investigate closely held businesses, real estate portfolios, art collections, aircraft, trust interests, and complex financial instruments. There are also plenty of planning opportunities short of moving out of the state to avoid this tax enabled by Section 2031. Debt leveraging, which has already been spoken about, borrowing against Minnesota situs assets and investing the proceeds in out-of-state or excluded assets, and entity restructuring to obtain valuation discounts for minority interests and closely family-held assets. Finally, the number of OECD members levying wealth taxes in the world fell from 12 in 1990 to just 4 in 2017. The key arguments for repeal focused on efficiency costs and capital flight, with the OECD finding that net wealth taxes often fail to achieve their redistributive objectives. Subnational wealth taxation could be expected to create far more issues for the simple reason that border effects are so much lower. We can certainly appreciate the frustration with the federal government failing in their classic public finance obligations, but respectfully suggest that a state net wealth tax is not a solution. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Next we have Jada Scott, followed by Patrick Guernsey. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair and members of committee. My name is Jada Scott. I am a child care provider in North Minneapolis and a leader with Kids Count on Us, and I'm here to testify in favor of House File 4616 because I see every day how the families we serve and the teachers who care for them struggle while the rich get richer. While the rich are getting richer, families can't afford what it costs to provide high-quality child care, and child care providers can't survive if they charge any less. It's a puzzle that can't be solved using the current revenue model. Families will never be able to afford the true cost of care, especially with prices rising dramatically in a world where wages are not even close to keeping pace. To build and sustain the universal child care system we desperately need, we need to raise revenue. Minnesota is a wealthy state, but the richest 1% own nearly one-third of the wealth. Those in the bottom 50% own only 5% of the wealth. Here's the thing. None of the people in the 1% would own that amount of wealth without child care or many of the other community services we all provide through our tax dollars. The 1% are largely corporate executives and business owners. You cannot run a corporation or a business without child care. 76% of families with children between 0 and 6 have both parents in the workforce. Without childcare, those corporations and businesses wouldn't have employees. The childcare workforce and the families shouldering the burden of paying for childcare are integral in this wealth building, but not reaping any benefits. The median hourly wage of a childcare worker in Minnesota is about $15. A corporate executive wouldn't last a day as a childcare teacher. 1% is an amount that will hardly feel like a blip to someone with $10 million in assets, but will make an invaluable impact on our communities. We cannot solve the childcare puzzle without increasing revenue. I urge you to pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Patrick Guernsey is next, followed by Becca Dryden. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Patrick Guernsey. I'm a paid parent home care worker for my son, Ian, who is 25 years old and has autism. I'm also a proud member of SEIU Healthcare Minnesota and Iowa. Thank you for this opportunity to share our support for HF 4616 and HF 4123, two bills that would increase taxes on the wealthiest Minnesotans so that we can fund the essential services Minnesotans depend on. As a healthcare worker, I am responsible for Ian's care, meaning feeding, bathing, grooming, dressing, toileting, and recreation. He has poor motor skills. It means he cannot tie his shoes or cut his food at meals. He's a vulnerable person and needs 24/7 supervision. I'm assisted by his mother and three paid staff person. It is physically and emotionally demanding, but is also rewarding. I see every day how important this work is to ensure personal well-being and dignity of all Minnesotans, regardless of their race, age, or disability status. Having Ian at home also saves the state three or four times the cost of having him put in a group home or some related institution. The kind of care SEIU members provide is not optional. It is the most basic human need and is in all of our best interests to make sure to support it. Healthcare workers make it so that parents go to work, children can grow up healthy, and low-income families affected by severe medical conditions are not driven into poverty. I'm here today because I know how important it is that Minnesota invests in the services for families and children depend on. In 2023, the state of Minnesota funded a life-changing contract for workers like me. These wages were a lifeline to thousands struggling to make ends meet while providing the care that keeps our society moving. But these investments alone won't be enough to sustain our vital care economy. Without this assistance, families will be driven into poverty. Before I got waived services for Ian, his medicine co-pays were costing me over $300 a month. I'm not a poor person. I've worked all my life and don't deserve to be driven into poverty so care for my disabled adult son. These two bills will help meet the needs by asking the wealthiest Minnesotans to contribute more back to society that helped create their wealth in the first place. That way, we can invest in healthcare, support workers, and fully fund services like mine. I'm asking you to support these bills so that healthcare workers, families, their kids, and adult children, like my son, have the resources they need to live with dignity and thrive. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Last is Becca Dryden. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Norris and members of the committee, my name is Becca Dryden, and I'm a member of Minneapolis Families for Public Schools and a South Minneapolis mom of two. I'm here today to ask you to take a very small step toward the wealthiest Minnesotans paying a little bit closer to their fair share. I'm from Tennessee, and when I moved to Minneapolis, I was shocked to find that my kids were in the largest classrooms they'd ever experienced. Our kids' schools' kindergarten classes had nearly 30 students, far more than any educator can be expected to handle, and definitely too many to provide the education that our kids deserve. I was recently invited to attend a high school production of 9 to 5. It was an emotional invitation because this will be the last theater production that these children get to have in MPS, because their high school's entire theater program is being cut. Minneapolis schools recently received their budgets for next year, and schools across the district are seeing vital staff being cut in order to have closer to appropriate class sizes, because there is not enough money. we're losing English language learning specialists, education support professionals, mental health counselors, and arts programming. Outside of Minneapolis, Anoka-Hennepin is facing massive cuts, Bemidji Elementary School is facing closure, and school districts across the state need your help. When my kids started school in Minneapolis, big class sizes weren't all we found. That big classroom was full of students eager to learn. That big classroom had an educator who pours everything they have into our children every single day. And when I got to meet the parents of that big classroom, I met caregivers from all walks of life who, like me, would do anything to ensure that our children could be safe, nurtured, and given the beautiful education they deserve. We have every ingredient we need for the most incredible public education in the world, except the money. And it's infuriating that at the same time, there's a tiny handful of Minnesotans who have more money than they could ever spend in this lifetime. I'm here today to ask you, please, to pass House File 4616 for our children. Thank you.
Thank you. That's all the folks who signed up to testify in advance. Is there anyone else from the public who wishes to testify? And we did ask the scheduled testifiers to keep their testimony to 2 minutes, and so we'll ask any members of the public to do so as well. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
I'm Nathaniel M. Olson, the disability advocate for the state of Minnesota. Here we go. Taxing the wealthy, right? Taxing the rich. I've heard it so many times again in 2026. It was not the problem when the Biden-Harris administration was in office, and now we're in 2026, let's tax the rich. You know the problem why we're having all of these cuts, ladies and gentlemen? We're having all these cuts because we have fraud happening in the state of Minnesota. And what Governor Walz thinks, well, to cover up the fraud, I need to cut services like disability services, school services, all that sort of stuff. It's not because the wealthy, we need to tax the wealthy. It's because Governor Walz is cutting services to cover up this fraud. You remember what you guys, what the Democrats did last time when we had an 18 plus surplus and found out we had a $6 billion deficit? They came on and had a press conference and blamed Donald J. Trump. Wait a second. What does Donald J. Trump have to do with the state of Minnesota? Do you know what the Democrats should have done? Is hold Governor Walz accountable and said where on earth the money went. Our taxes are being thrown out, being funded overseas, and now we want to tax the wealthy. We want to tax the wealthy. The wealthy has nothing to do with this. What is happening is Governor Walz is cutting stuff to cover this fraud. What should be on the floor today, the main point of the House and the legislature and the Senate is combating this fraud and put a stop to it, because people are going to go homeless. Not raising taxes, not blaming the wealth, but we need to start holding our governor accountable, and that is what I need to see from the Minnesota Democrats. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other members of the public who wish to testify? Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Norris, members of the committee. My name is Eric Bernstein. I'm a coalition director of We Make Minnesota. We advocate for a fair tax code and a budget to meet our public investment needs. I didn't sign up officially, but I was just kind of one point as I was sitting and listening, I wanted to kind of drive home. I think it's just to say that some bills are about choosing from our options right now, and some bills are about reshaping the options that we have. I think Chair Gomez's comments were exactly right, that this reflects the world that we live in, and we need to start figuring out how to adapt to that world. Capital accumulated wealth today is different than it was in the Golden Age, which was mentioned. It's mobile, it's detached from places and specific businesses. The comments about economic dynamism I thought were interesting, because I can understand how a tax code could incentivize different economic behavior, investing in a certain place or starting a certain kind of a business. But incentivizing the returns to wealth that is already accumulated is different than that. So avoiding policies like this shifts us more towards income taxes and other taxes that you could say disincentivize that productive activity. And we have, in our coalition's opinion, very high incentives on the returns to accumulated fortunes, as opposed to having an economy that incentivizes that sort of productive business, investment and that kind of more productive economic activity. So I just wanted to make those couple of points, and I think Mark Haverman's points about implementation, very well taken. But that's why we need to have these conversations and take them seriously, because it will take time to get to a place where we can pass a policy like this, but it is important. Everybody is concerned about wealth inequality, and this is a great idea to start that conversation. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Anyone else from the public? All right, seeing none, we'll go to member testimony. We're going to first bring Representative Egbaje back up, and Representative Egbaje is going to move that House File 4123 be laid over for possible inclusion in the 2026 tax bill. We'll first take member discussion to Representative Egbaje's bill, then we'll move Chair Gomez's bill and discuss that. Representative Witte, was your question or comment to Representative Egbaje's bill?
Second.
The second one? All right. Representative Weiner, was your comment or question second? Anybody who wishes, Representative Strudzinski.
I was just going to, did the department want to make a comment on the bill or against?
Does the department is shaking their head no. All right.
Smart.
Representative Anderson to Representative Egbaje's bill.
No.
Second one. All right. Anybody, if you've got anything for Representative Egbaje's bill, please raise your hand. All right. Final words to Representative Egbaje.
Sure. I can understand the desire to want to talk more specifically on the actual wealth tax. I will just say this. I think for both bills, this is an opportunity for us to have a conversation about what it actually means to structure a society that pays for itself, and what it actually means to have a society where folks who have been successful are contributing in a way that makes the community rich for all of us. I think we heard from a number of testifiers who are in those spaces, what is sometimes called the care economy, about teaching, about healthcare, about providing for others. How do we ensure that we have the resources to make sure that people can still be able to do that and do that at a high level of quality for those who are more vulnerable in our society? I think a bill like this, particularly one that is already using the foundation of what we've laid about 2 years ago or 3 years ago, and as well as building on the foundation of what the federal government has already done over 10 years ago, is an excellent, method or path forward that we can take as we continue to think about how we use these taxes in order to better benefit our society. So that is what I'll say on that, and then looking forward to the conversation on the next bill, and I'm sure I'll have something to say on that as well, too. So.
Thank you, Representative Egbaje. And with that, Representative Egbaje renews her motion that House File 4123 be laid over for possible inclusion in the 2026 tax bill. The bill is laid over. All right. Next, we've got Chair Gomez back up. Chair Gomez moves that House File 4616 be laid over for possible inclusion in the tax bill. It looks like we've got some robust discussion that members are looking forward to having, and we'll start with Representative Witte.
Thank you, Chair Norris, or Vice Chair Norris. Thank you, Chair Gomez. I don't have to, I was going to get on the fraud piece, but I think that was pretty well covered, so thank you. But what I do really want to talk about is, a preview of what we're looking at. This session, this group, the GOP, tax cuts for all Minnesotans. Tips, overtime, sales tax, gas tax inflator removal, charitable gambling rate, and property tax. What we just heard from our colleagues across the aisle is over $1 billion in new taxes right now, digital advertising taxes, social media tax, and a fifth-tier income tax today. Minnesota is becoming less affordable, and people are leaving our state and our businesses. I think it's our, obviously, the way we see things. People have different versions, but I think a lot of the things that are happening are hurting Minnesotans. And I will just say, when I was a police officer, Gordon Graham, one of the things we used to always have a saying, predictable is preventable. And in 2023, when we had a DFL trifecta, they passed vehicle registration tab increase, vehicle sales tax increase, a retail delivery fee, a gas tax inflator, a metro transportation sales tax 0.75%, a metro housing sales tax of 0.25%, and a payroll tax and paid family leave. And that was with an $18.5 billion surplus. We raised taxes by $10 billion. I don't believe Minnesotans got their money's worth, and the fraud is a huge part of it. What could we be doing with the $10 billion that didn't go to the people that it was designed to help? So I'm just, predictable is preventable, and this is a preview of what we see in this session.
All right. Thank you, Representative Witte. Next up is Representative Wiener.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair and Madam Chair. Very similar to some conversations that took place with another bill not all that long ago. But you made a statement that we would update Minnesota's tax code with the rest of the world. But the fact of the matter is there's no other states that have a similar tax idea that what you're putting forth here. No other state has passed a similar wealth tax to what you're presenting. But the tax the rich mantra has been going on forever. And when we discussed that, I believe it was last year with the, it might have been the fifth tier, but I brought up the window tax that was presented in Europe in the Middle Ages. We've also talked about the Golden Ages here. What like there is some pristine time in our tax code where everything was great and everybody was treated equitably. That has never been the case. So with the window tax that they had in the Middle Ages, if you had extra windows, it was considered a sign of wealth. So what happened? The rich simply boarded up their windows. And to this day, there is still windows in Europe that are boarded over and covered up, because when these things get put into place, people find inventive ways to get around them. In Minnesota, we've seen this already with our tax code. The adjusted gross income in this state, we have lost billions of dollars already because of the tax structure here. We have simply driven out people. And the IRS does a very great job of following every penny that comes in and out of this state. So it's not conjecture, it's not supposition that we've lost high earners because they simply can leave. And then where does the tax burden fall? Once again, on the middle class. So in the 1930s, another little bit of a history lesson, the income tax was implemented in the state of Minnesota to make things more equitable. And only the high earners, or the earner, it was going to be based on earnings, I'm sorry, and the high earners would pay more. And where does that fall today? Once again, the middle class ends up footing the bill for this. We do this again and again and again. This is not new. It simply doesn't work. And all the states around us just watch our tax structure here get worse and worse for our citizens because businesses can move. The rich can move, and they will. South Dakota's had open arms for all of the businesses and individuals that we are driving out of our state, and they're seeing great growth. It's amazing to me that we keep coming up with the same ideas that have been tried and tried and have failed so many times before. So some of the things that I was also going to mention, thanks for stealing the thunder there a little bit, Representative Witte, but $10 billion in taxes over the last, well, the last biennium. When is enough enough? It seems like there's insatiable lust for more taxes, and yet when you see our spending in this state over the last 10 years has nearly doubled from a $35 billion budget in this state to almost $70 billion. We haven't fixed the problems yet, have we? But somehow taxing more is going to fix the problems. This is insanity, and I'm just surprised that we're even having this discussion again on a bill like this. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wiener. Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Can I ask Mark Kavman, is he still here? Yeah. I have a question for, he was over there.
Mr. Havenman will make his way up to the testifier table.
Thank you. You said something about 5,600 taxpayers in your testimony, and I was just wondering what that number is, because I was looking at the what's the top 1% for assets, and it was I got a national number, and it said 13 million.
It's on the very last page of the.
It's in the revenue estimate.
Okay, so the top 1% for assets in the country is 13.6 million. So my guess is this would actually, if we're an average state, it would actually pull in about the top 2% in assets and taxpayers. So I was maybe
Mr. Hayden,
neither one of you can give that number because I think it's way higher than 5,600 taxpayers.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I went off the revenue estimate provided by Department of Revenue. That was where the 5,600 came from. I did do a little cross-checking just to sort of see what others have to say about this. And looking at some Fed data, and I can't remember the other resource off the top of my head, but it seems like 5,000 to 9,000 is probably a pretty decent estimate based on the different sources that I've seen.
Representative Anderson.
Oh, okay, thank you. So I find that number really low because if it's the top, because we're looking at an asset number, not an income number, you know, overall assets of privately held businesses, of stocks, bonds, retirement accounts, you know, everything. It encompasses everything within this. So I was trying to get maybe a little more accurate number. But thank you. I don't know that it matters because this isn't going to pass anyway, but I have a couple questions about the volatility of this. This has never been done anywhere in the country. When it was done in France, it was a disaster, and they repealed that wealth tax. I don't know if it's even constitutional. There's a big question about the constitutionality of a wealth tax. Is there any look at the volatility of this type of tax? Has there been any discussion or look as you're thinking of these things? Because I think this isn't going to be incredibly volatile as an income.
Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So any time that you know, the taxing the highest income people, which is highly, I understand that it's assets. Mm-hmm. You can talk about the wealthiest people then. Mm-hmm. But income and wealth do, you know, track together somewhat, not perfectly. Anytime that you are assessing a tax on a small number of people who are highly mobile, it's a volatile revenue source. This would be a volatile revenue source. Mm-hmm.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. I think it's would be incredibly volatile. I think that should this pass, which I think it's impossible to manage to begin with, because you're going to have most of this is going to be within privately held companies or, you know, those sort of things. And you're going to have the Department of Revenue, which is going to need thousands of people to do audits, and you're going to have folks that are maybe being caught up in this, then they're going to spend a fortune on accounting, and you're going to have this thing with the state while the whole thing is fought in the courts, because I don't think it's constitutionally in it, but you're just absolutely chasing people out of the state, because it's a different thing when you have to pay your taxes at maybe a higher rate. It's obvious this is your income, but when you're actually fighting over a value of assets, you know, there's a huge cost to people to do that, and there's a huge cost to the state to attempt to value things every year, not just upon sale, which is the normal. It's valued upon sale. And I think this absolutely sends, just the fact that we're having this discussion, you know, sends a message to a lot more than 5,600 people, because I think there are people that own tons of property, farms and those sort of things that probably maybe have land that's worth X, but it certainly doesn't kick off $1 million in income. or maybe they have, you know, various, you know, properties or closely held businesses which have a value, but a certain, again, doesn't kick off, you know, a huge, maybe doesn't even kick off $500,000, but it's worth $10 million, the actual business. And we're sending a message to people that they're not wanted here. We're sending a message to people not to invest in the state. And we see it happening. We are losing people in every income bracket except the bottom income bracket. We are losing population. Our large companies, if they're still here, the corporate headquarters, are not expanding in Minnesota. They're expanding outside of Minnesota. And it's like this slow, you know, spiral to the bottom, this slow death. And I really, really fear for what's been happening in Minnesota and what's going to happen in the future, because people can move, and they do. And if they are attacked, I look at this as an attack on people. And if they're attacked, you know, they don't need to deal with it, and they're not going to stay. And I wanted to, I'll end, but I wanted to tell you something else. So there used to be a plaza placed by the U years ago, a long time ago. And actually, that's how a lot of people paid their tuition or bought beer money, including me. So I sold my plaza at that place by the U. And so the world, you know, it isn't just folks in that are, you know, are poor. It's you know, we've all been there and done that. So I just wanted you to know that. I don't have anything else. I just think this is a huge attack. It's not constitutional. It's bad to even be doing this. And, you know, it's going to just spiral us.
Chair Gomez. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that comparing yourself selling your plasma for beer money in college when there are literally people who are selling their plasma, who are working full-time, who have families, who are trying to make an extra $150 a week in order to make their insurance premiums and pay their food bills and pay their rent is pretty insulting. And to I use that as an example of how difficult it is for working class people in this state. And I understand if your experience is separated from that, but I would ask you to think about that. To think about having kids, working full-time, and going to the plasma center in the richest country that's ever existed on the face of the earth to make your rent. Please don't diminish people's experiences of economic hardship in our state. Please don't do that. I think it's really insensitive. And I find it pretty shocking, given the fact that, you know, there's all these, you know, you guys like to get up and give press conferences about affordability, and I'm literally telling you about what people are facing in our communities, and you're diminishing it and comparing it to making beer money during college. That's not most people's reality. And we're going to have to disagree, because I believe that we should be making public policy decisions based on the public good, based on how it is that we as a government meet the basic obligations that we have to our people, which are outlined in the Constitution of our state. I do not believe that we should be making public policy decisions based on whether or not rich people are going to feel attacked and sue us. That's not the basis on which we make decisions. I think that there's a lot of conversation that has to happen here, but if we, like, based our public policy decisions on whether or not rich people and businesses would sue us, then we would never do anything. All we do is, like, rename a post office. And so to me, that is just not a compelling argument to say, oh, it's gonna, you know, lock us up in litigation. And I acknowledge this. I just want to say, like, like, Mr. Haveman's absolutely correct, and we had a lot of conversations about this. It's like, you know, the right level on which to do a wealth tax is federally, because then, you know, you can do those sort of that analysis of people's fortunes at scale. Mm-hmm. But our federal government is like nowhere near doing this. And, you know, so there are real conversations to be had about how it is that you would actually administer something like this. Maybe you would, maybe ultimately if we were going to do this, we would just do it on, you know, assets that you could easily value, for example. All of those decisions, those policy decisions have implications, right? Because to the discussion that we've had today, tax policy, you know, some of us maybe overemphasize the influence that it has on people's behavior, but it certainly has an influence on people's behavior. But I do just like, I think that to dismiss this out of hand and to talk about it as an attack on people and to make light of the difficulty that regular people are having meeting their basic needs of them and their children is really insensitive. And like, everybody kind of realizes this is a problem. Like, look around. I open your email and read about some of the, I mean, I don't know much about your district, but we all have people who are struggling in our districts. We all have people struggling to make ends meet. And we got to be serious about, you know, what are we going to do to try to address that as we have simultaneously, you know, working class people not able to make ends meet and just runaway wealth. Incomprehensible levels of wealth just getting more and more and more concentrated in the hands of the few. So, you know, I mean, we're going to have to disagree about the basis on which we make public policy decisions, but there's more conversation to have about some of the issues that you raised, and so I appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. We've got a long list of members, so we're going to have to keep moving on here. Next is Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, I just wanted to bring us back to the bill and what it actually does. Want to make sure we don't miss a point that Mr. Bernstein made. You know, the questions that we should be asking is, you know, who is being taxed and what is being taxed? What we've heard from, you know, our colleagues across the aisle are really kind of like perennial critiques of, you know, any attempt at all to rein in, again, this runaway wealth that has only been accelerated because of OBBA, right? You know, at the federal level, the IRS is not doing its job. There are massive cuts to the department, and I think at least a third, if not more, of the auditors have been fired. But the most important thing, right, is that OBBA cost us $1 trillion, and there are these massive cuts to social programs that were used to pay for these corporate tax breaks, right? And so the reason why this is a problem is not just because we need to figure out how to balance our budget next year. It's also because this K-shaped economy is going to come back and affect us even more as we go forward, right? Like these provisions have only accelerated this wealth inequality or this income inequality. And I think that distinction is really important. So Mr. Bernstein said, you know, if this were an income tax, right, like these arguments about people leaving Minnesota would actually be applicable, but this is a wealth tax. And again, we you know, would be, when we tax wealth, it's different than taxing income. So I just want to make sure our colleagues across the aisle understand that. You know, rich people are not going to move. They're just going to use their money to buy expensive artwork and like put it in, you know, warehouses, right? That's really different. You know, and I also find this conversation really interesting, because when I presented my bill about the renter's credit, you know, someone mentioned that, you know, helping people making $150,000 was way too rich, right? But again, like, that's helping parents who make, you know, about maybe $75,000 a year. Like, that's not a lot of money. And so I want to thank Chair Gomez for bringing this bill before us, and for refocusing on what this bill actually does, right? Like, I think You know, we can have conversations about income tax, but a wealth tax is something that is appropriate for our time when, you know, there are federal policies that allow people to accumulate wealth at a faster rate than any other time in our history. And, you know, everyone else in our districts are just trying to figure out how to make rent. Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Chair Gomez, for this conversation. So I just have a practical question. I think Mr. Haberman discussed how hard it is to value people's real property and the art and all this on an annual basis. But I wondered, how on earth are you going to value or figure out the sum of all the debts and financial obligations each taxpayer owes? Like, what's the mechanism for the department to do that?
Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, we would ask the taxpayer, I assume. I don't think they would underreport their debts and obligations that they owe. It would be part of the filing process, would be to report your debts and obligations.
Representative Robbins.
Can I ask the department, like, what their view of how that would work is or how they would do that? Would they have to?
They've
Mr. Chair.
Already indicated they have no yeah. position on the bill.
Yeah, the... as I said, you know, there's conversation to be had about the administration of this.
Okay.
I don't think that, you know, the department's not, doesn't have a position on this bill. I've not worked with them on the administrative aspects of it, so I don't think that they will have much, they don't have an answer to your question.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you. All right. Well, certainly that's an important piece of understanding this. And to the larger discussion, I just wanted to comment. I've heard a lot today about the struggles that are real for middle class and low income people to make ends meet. And I think that is absolutely real and something that we need to deal with. And we have a lot of ideas. You have a lot of ideas. But I just want the public to understand that the reason people are struggling to make ends meet is because of the tax policy that the majority did in this committee, and I'd like to associate myself with Representative Witte's remarks, but just remind everyone, like, the reason people are having trouble affording their lives is because you increased the vehicle tab fee, increased the vehicle sales tax, increased the retail delivery fee, increased the gas tax and tied it to inflation, the metropolitan transportation and housing sales tax, 1%, and now requesting another 1% increase in the sales tax this year. The payroll tax for paid family leave, like, the reason people can't afford their lives is because they are being taxed to death. And if we could return more money to taxpayers, let them keep more of what they earned, they would be able to provide for their families and make their rent payments and all of that. Our lowest tax rate in the state of Minnesota, 5.35%, is higher than the highest tax rate in 30 other states. Like, we are so uncompetitive in our tax rates, and that's what's hitting the lowest income and the middle income families. So we need to think about how can we let people keep more of their own money so that they can be successful and not just get by, but invest and create wealth and start businesses so that they can move up. That's what people are asking us for. And I feel like this bill substantially misunderstands what people want and how they want to afford their lives. They don't want more government handouts and to be more dependent. They want to have more of their own money and to be able to create wealth for themselves and their families. Thank you.
Chair Gomez.
Thank you so much. Just a few things. You know, classic promotion of trickle-down economics. That's just what we're hearing. Cut tax rates, it'll be great for low-income people. Well, that happened in the 80s. And as I said, in the last 30 years, we have seen just an absolutely unprecedented level of wealth stratification in our country. It's directly related to tax policy decisions. And this investment in trickle-down economics, like a completely discredited theory. People want to view wealth stratification. They want to view, you know, wealth inequality, the runaway fortunes of the uber-wealthy and the struggles of working-class people as separate from one another. Like, I understand why you would want us to separate those things, but they are connected. They are connected. Our labor creates value that gets extracted and gets by those who own capital. That's our system. The struggles of working class people and the greed of the wealthy are connected. I understand why you want us to look at them separately, but they're connected. And finally, I appreciate all the discussion of the 2023 transportation bill that we have all the time when we talk about 2023 policy, but none of those decisions were made here, so, you know, thanks for turning us into transportation committee, but thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We're going to keep moving. We've got a floor that we need to get to, members. We have a few more who want to get in here on the conversation, and we're going to go to Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair Gomez. I want to talk about something that we haven't talked about yet based on the testimony on this bill, and it comes up anytime we talk about taxing wealth, and it is using the small business owners of Minnesota as a shield so the ultra-wealthy don't have to invest in the state of Minnesota through their obligation in taxes. Happens every time we talk about taxing wealth is that businesses can't be competitive if we pass something like this. I am a small business owner. I own a small business in Rochester. I know many small business owners of retail shops, plumbers, drivers, they own bakeries and restaurants. All of them would dream of a day that they would have to pay 1% on a $10 million fortune that they own. And the true, honest answer is none of them get into small business because they're expecting to get to a $10 million fortune in Minnesota. It's because they love their communities and they love what they do. And they love the idea of being their own boss, of providing a service or a new restaurant or a new kind of experience where they live, where they work, and they love doing it. And none of them would say, I guess maybe some of them. The vast majority would not say that my business or our businesses can only thrive when students suffer with bigger class sizes and losing services, and their teachers have to work weekends driving Uber. Businesses can only thrive when roads and bridges crumble from neglect. Our businesses can only thrive when workers work longer hours for less pay, working multiple jobs, getting less benefits. Businesses can only thrive when families pay more and more for childcare, and then those who are providing the childcare also have to work multiple jobs because they're not getting paid. That these businesses can only thrive when Minnesotans, their rents and their home ownership prices are rising while private equity buys more and more homes to make money on that they don't have to pay taxes on because they're not realized. No small business owner is going to make that argument to you. And they don't want to be used as a shield so that the ultra wealthy who have immense taxes continue to cheat on their obligations to our society, to our state, to our people, to our education system, to our roads, to our bridges, to our children who are being watched by our child care providers, to our doctors, our nurses. And it's time that they pick up those responsibilities. And arguments that say they're going to cheat in other ways is a horrible argument to not get at them to pay what they owe. And they do owe it to us. We all owe it to each other. That's what taxes is.
Thank you. Representative Howard.
Thank you. I'll try to be brief. The point that I wanted to raise is related to what's been brought up a couple times about what kind of message we're sending with this bill and who is the recipient of that message. And what I would, we've heard from folks on the other side that we're sending a message to the handful of the wealthiest Minnesotans that this is not a good place to do business. What I would submit is the audience for this message are renters who are struggling to afford their rent, that have seen rent outpace their income year over year, to families who have seen childcare costs go up by 15-20%, far outpacing their wages, to college students who can't fathom the idea of earning enough to own a home, to the millions of working class Minnesotans that just want to work hard and earn enough to make a living without the pressure that they're not going to be able to meet the needs of their families. And so the message we're sending is that we think that wealth inequality is a major problem. And there has been a version of this debate, as Representative Weiner mentioned, for years, a classic debate about taxing and spending and really the role of government. But what I would submit is new in the last few years is an amazingly multiplying wealth gap. You know, between 1989 and 2022, the poorest households and the top 1% gained 987 times more wealth than the richest households in the bottom 20%. And that is all before Trump passed the big bad bill, the largest transfer of wealth from the middle class to the rich in our nation's history. And so if the question is what message are we trying to send, it's that wealth inequality is a stain on our state and our country, and that we're going to do something about it. And who we're trying to send that message to is the millions of Minnesotans who work hard every day and are just trying to provide for their family. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, to wrap us up, Chair Gomez.
I appreciate the good conversation. I think that Representative Howard kind of wrapped it up nicely for us. I guess I just would ask people to think about whether, you know, we should only tax the assets of the middle class, or we should also tax the assets of the wealthy. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And with that, Chair Gomez renews her motion that House File 4616 be laid over for possible inclusion in the 2026 tax bill. The bill is laid over. All right, we'll go to Chair Davids for a preview of tomorrow.
Thank you very much, Chair Norris. Exciting day tomorrow, House File 1669, the Davids bill, also known as the SAF bill, House File 4709, Mueller, House File 3531, Joy, House File 4048, Robbins. Be there or be square.
All right, we will. And with that, I guess we'll be there, not be square, to clarify. Yeah. And with that, members, we are adjourned. I'm going to go.